Hello and welcome to Yesterday's News, the podcast that brings you the biggest stories from this week in history. I'm Joe Forrester and I'll be guiding you through the historical headlines from the earth-shattering to the absurd. And remember, you can follow the show at Very Old News and please do get involved. No tweet is too trivial for our attention. On with the show. First up, we're at Stalingrad as Hitler sacrifices hundreds of thousands of his own men to cold, starvation and cannibalism. Next, we meet the architect of a rebellion against Bloody Mary. And finally, we bear witness to the first liberation of Nazi death camps at the end of the Second World War. First up, it's the 24th of January 1942, and you join us live from Stalingrad, a large industrial city on the Volga River, about 600 miles southeast of Moscow. The city has been in the midst of a titanic struggle since July last year, as the Soviet Red Army and the German Wehrmacht do battle over the city that bears the Soviet leader's name. After initial German gains, the fighting in the city proved to be a brutal hand-to-hand affair, and in November of 1942, Soviet forces under General Zhukov launched a counter-offensive. And when the city was surrounded by over 1 million soldiers, the 250,000 Germans within were doomed. Despite this, German army leader General Paulus received this communication from Hitler. From the Supreme Commander to the 6th Army, January 24th, 1943. Surrender is forbidden. 6th Army will hold their positions to the last man and the last round, and by their heroic endurance will make an unforgettable contribution towards the establishment of a defensive front and the salvation of the Western world. This seems a good time to take a step back and look at why the greatest battle of the Second World War was taking place over a city of seemingly minor significance. Stalingrad, you see, was a battle of egos. The German invasion of the Soviet Union had, initially, been a stunning, startling success. Launched in June 1941, Operation Barbarossa, named after the great German Emperor of the Middle Ages, had found itself within 15 miles of Moscow by October. That's around 600 miles in 4 months. However, the harsh Russian winter set in and the Germans, gambling on taking Moscow by Christmas, were simply not equipped to cope with it. Hitler then turned his attention to the oil fields of the Caucasus, far to the south, the idea being to cripple Russian industry by removing their oil supply. However, on the way was the city of Stalingrad. While it was definitely unwise to leave a major city behind you as you advanced, the Germans didn't need to take Stalingrad to ensure they secured the oil fields. However, many have hypothesised Hitler saw victory there as symbolic, as taking the city that bore the name of the enemy commander would strike a huge blow to the morale of the Soviet people. For this very reason, Stalin too decreed the city would not fall, ordering not one step backwards. Those who fled were shot on the battlefield by their own commanding officers. Stalin's obstinacy ultimately saved the city, but moreover, his appointment of the brilliant general Georgi Zhukov was decisive. After Zhukov turned the tide in November 1942, the encircled German soldiers succumbed to frostbite. One recorded his only remaining functioning digit was his little finger, which was still, and I quote, good for shooting, and starvation, often killing and eating their horses, and some reports suggest even their fallen comrades. Hitler issued his no-surrender order on the 24th of January 1943, even promoting Paulus to Field Marshal, reminding him that no German officer holding that rank had ever surrendered. Paulus ignored Hitler and chose instead to attempt to save his men. On January 31st, he agreed to surrender, and on February the 2nd, the 91,000 Germans inside the city were taken prisoner. They were broken, starving men. Only 6,000 of them would ever make it home. According to records, Stalin and Hitler's refusal to budge cost the lives of up to 1.1 million Soviet soldiers, 800,000 Axis soldiers and 40,000 civilians, nearly 2 million people in total. Defeat at Stalingrad was the major turning point of the Second World War, and the Russian advance that would end in May 1945, with Hitler dead in his bunker, began there. Operation Barbarossa yielded some stunning and harrowing statistics. Over 3 million German soldiers advanced over a front of 1,800 miles in the summer of 1941, advancing 600 miles in 4 months, and in the first 3 days of the operation alone, destroying nearly 4,000 Russian aircraft, many on the ground, for a loss of fewer than 100 German planes. However, the real story is told in people. 5 million Soviet prisoners of war were taken. Over 3 million were deliberately starved. More than 1 million Jews were murdered. 1,700 settlements were destroyed. And in total, 26 million Soviet citizens lost their lives in the Second World War. One in every seven of the total population. accounting for nearly half of the conflict's total casualties. Next, it's the 25th of January 1554, and Joe Forrester is in Kent with Sir Thomas Wyatt the Younger as he prepares a rebellion against Queen Mary. Joe. Thanks, Joe. That's right. I'm here with Sir Thomas. Sir Thomas, can you tell us the purpose of this gathering today?
Of course I can, old man. And may I say how lovely your tunic is.
Thanks.
Well, as we all know, Queen Mary is planning to marry that absolute rascal Philip of Spain and is already reinstating stinky old Catholicism across this fair land. And we can't have that, can we, Joe?
I guess not.
So I'm leading my 4,000 brave lads here against the forces of the Queen, while two other rebellions occur in the Midlands and the West Country, while the French Navy blockades the pesky Spanish in the Channel.
And what happens then?
Oh, my dear boy. We put that lovely girl Elizabeth on the throne, England is Protestant again, and we're all home in time for tea. Huzzah!
Well, good luck.
Thanks, old boy.
Let's fast forward to the executioner's scaffold on Tower Hill, London, the 11th of April. Sir Thomas, good to see you again, but things don't seem to have gone exactly to plan.
No, Joe, but I'm fairly happy I did my best.
What about the Princess Elizabeth? Was she involved in this plot?
Joe, all I can say is, for I assure you neither they nor any other now in yonder hold or durance was privy of my rising or commotion before I began.
Thanks, Tom. Best of luck, mate.
Yes, jolly good. Thanks, old bean. Ah, here comes my final engagement now. Good day to you, sir. That's quite the axe you have.
Back to you, Joe. Yes, Sir Thomas Wyatt the Younger used his scaffold speech to exonerate Princess Elizabeth, the future Elizabeth I, despite the fact he's believed to have been tortured. You see, all the trouble began in 1553, when Edward VI died, aged 15. And just as you'd expect from a teenage boy, with his dying breath, he tried to stitch up his annoying sisters. Edward made an amendment to his will, signed on his own deathbed, that barred both Mary and Elizabeth from succeeding, despite the fact that had been his father, Henry VIII's, desire. Instead, he nominated his cousin, the 16-year-old Lady Jane Grey, as his heir. However, upon Edward's death, news reached Mary in East Anglia, and she summoned her supporters to march on London. Poor old Jane Grey, otherwise known as the Nine Days Queen for obvious reasons, must have wished she was raiding her parents' liquor cabinet and getting felt up by spotty teenage boys at house parties like all her other pals, not in the middle of a national political emergency. Mary's forces won the day, Jane was put under a comfortable house arrest, and her leading supporter, the Duke of Northumberland, sadly bid farewell to his head. However, by early 1554, it was clear that Mary wasn't to be the shy and retiring type, and had already forced a bill through Parliament declaring that she would have the same rights as any king who had gone before. Mary, you see, was England's first anointed female ruler. And while the country had certainly had queen consorts before, and of course, as I'm sure many of you sat at home will be saying, Queen Matilda back in the 12th century, she was never actually crowned. So Mary was England's first queen to rule in her own right. She'd also made it obvious she wouldn't be cowed by her ministers and was arranging a love match with her cousin Philip, heir to the Spanish throne. The problem was that Catholic Spain was England's arch enemy, very much the evil Sith to England's virtuous Jedi. Many rebellions sprang up, but Wyatt's was the most substantial and was part of the religious tug of war that would plague England for the next 250 years. Bloody Mary, as she's remembered by history, is often thought of as a bloodthirsty despot. However, a re-evaluation is in order. Yes, burning 300 odd people is definitely bad, but it pales in comparison to the actions of other monarchs, especially when you consider programmes like the Spanish Inquisition. Ultimately, England's first queen was unable to secure her legacy, as what were thought to be the signs of pregnancy actually turned out to be the symptoms of stomach cancer, and she died in 1558, replaced by her half-sister Elizabeth, who would end up at war with the very man Mary had married and had caused all this fuss, when Philip II of Spain sent the famous armada against her in 1588. Meanwhile, spare a thought for poor Lady Jane Grey, a frightened teenage girl and political pawn who Mary had executed shortly after Wyatt's rebellion, just to be safe. Life's really not fair, is it? And finally, it's the 26th of January 1945, and Soviet troops have just liberated Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp in southern Poland. What they found was a very real version of hell on earth. Upon entering the camp, the soldiers discovered some 7,000 prisoners and over 600 corpses. the Germans were nowhere in sight, having attempted to destroy much of the camp, and hence the evidence of their crimes, and taking 60,000 prisoners on a forced death march intended to kill them. They left only 7,000 of the most infirm. The soldiers also found 370,000 men's suits, 837,000 women's garments, and 7.7 tons of human hair. Since the Wannsee Conference, which we spoke about last week, the Nazis had industrialised the process of murdering those who didn't fit in with their worldview. And at Auschwitz-Birkenau, they built the largest of their complexes for killing human beings. In addition to the 300 prison barracks, there were also four bathhouses. The prisoners, who believed they were in transit for resettlement, were told they needed to shower to remove lice. Once inside the bathhouses, they were in fact murdered using gas, before being removed and burned in the purpose-built crematoria, but not before being stripped of their valuables, which were repurposed for the German war effort. Many prisoners were also handed over to camp doctor Josef Mengele, who experimented on them to try and prove the unscientific racial theories of eugenics. He was also known as the Angel of Death. To compound the lie they told their victims at Treblinka, another extermination camp, plants were placed on the railway station and at the entrance to the bathhouses to give some semblance of normality, while the station at the camp was disguised to look like a normal railway station, with signs, timetables, and even a clock painted on the wall. A Star of David was also placed above the entrance to the gas chamber, and a sign was painted on a purple curtain covering the entrance. It was written in Hebrew. It read, "This is the gateway to God. Righteous men will pass through." These small touches, little deceptions, the way those working at the camps tried to make their job of murdering people en masse easier, are just another element of this story that makes your skin crawl. 1.1 million prisoners died at Auschwitz. Jews, Roma gypsies, homosexuals, political prisoners and more. 6 million Jews died in total during the Holocaust, around 40% of the world's total population. And as we remember those who were murdered this Friday the 27th of January on Holocaust Memorial Day, we would also do well to remember the very worst place that hate, bigotry and cruelty to others can take us. There you have it. That's it for this week's stories. And before we finish with an idiom, let's have a look at some other headlines from this week in history. So on the 19th, Harry Houdini escaped from a Dutch police station. On the 24th in 1958, after being warmed to 100 million degrees, two light atoms were bashed together to create another heavier atom, which was the first example of man-made nuclear fusion. On the 25th in 1327, King Edward III, the kind of prototypical medieval campaigning king, ascended to the English throne. In 1964, on that same day, the Beatles had their first US number one with I Wanna Hold Your Hand. In 1971, on the 25th also, in a military coup in Uganda, General Idi Amin came to power. In 1944, Leningrad was liberated from the Germans after 888 days and with 600,000 people dead. And on the 26th of January 1998, President Bill Clinton famously said this.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Okay, so moving on to our idiom, it's one I promised you a couple of weeks ago, and it's Gordon Bennett. Now, for our listeners elsewhere, and I know we've got quite a few in the US, I don't know if this is something you have or if you have an equivalent phrase, but Gordon Bennett is basically an exclamation of surprise. So we might say Gordon Bennett, for example, if someone says, oh, the train's delayed, you're going to have to wait here an hour, you go, oh, Gordon Bennett. Or, for example, if you were to see a naked man running past your window, you might go, Gordon Bennett. That's a little bit of context. So what it comes from is a man actually named Gordon Bennett. Now, his father, of the same name, was a newspaper editor, but Gordon Bennett Jr. was a playboy. And he's also the man who took part in possibly the most embarrassing incident you could ever experience in front of your in-laws. In 1877, at a New Year's party held by his fiancée's father, Gordon Bennett became so drunk he mistook the fireplace for a toilet and urinated in it in front of his hosts and all their guests. And it's said to be, from this very moment, Gordon Bennett entered popular parlance as something where you'd say, man, Gordon Bennett. Something incredible, an exclamation of surprise. He was also famous for many other roguish stories and goings on. His legacy to history, apart from having a slash in the fireplace, is that we now have an idiom named after him. So there you go. So that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. And remember, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Very Old News. Please do get in touch. And remember, look out on iTunes and on Audio Boom as well for the specials. We've done chats with filmmaker Matt Bell, tech presenter and expert Marcus Bronzy. We've got Jules Breach from BT Sport coming up in the next few weeks. But in the meantime, every single Friday, don't forget, you can get your biggest headlines from history on yesterday's news, and I will see you next week.